The headlines: the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since Sunday rises to 4 as a state of alert is announced in parts of the occupied territory. Pakistan's parliament is set to elect a new prime minister amid political tensions following the ouster of Imran Khan in a no-confidence vote. And Ukraine says 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed for Monday between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from eastern regions. Hello and welcome, everybody. Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a 17-year-old man who succumbed to his injuries after Israeli forces shot him in Jenin in the occupied West Bank a day earlier. Mohammad Zakarneh's death raises the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since Sunday to 4. He was among the 10 Palestinians injured by Israeli live fire amid tensions over a Palestinian retaliatory attack that killed 3 in Tel Aviv on Wednesday. Regime forces also arrested 20 others. Resistance groups in Jenin have declared a state of alert to confront Israeli raids. 2 Palestinian women and 1 man were also shot dead across the occupied West Bank on Sunday. One of them, a widowed mother of 6, Palestinians have ramped up their resistance against the regime over the past months. They say this is a legitimate response to Israeli crimes and occupation. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, has given us more details about the Israeli killings of Palestinians the previous day.
Mohammed Zakarneh was wounded during the second raid to Jenin. Yesterday, Israeli forces raided Jenin. Israeli undercover units opened fire at a vehicle where the brother of Palestinian martyr who carried out the operation in Tel Aviv, Raed Hazem, the brother, his mother, and his younger brother were inside this vehicle. They were surprised to see Israeli forces. It was not an attempt to arrest them because the Israeli forces opened heavy fire at the vehicle. Mohammed Zakarneh, the 17-year-old Palestinian, was there and wounded in this incident. He was among 10 others were wounded. However, he succumbed to his injuries this morning. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, during the weekly cabinet meeting yesterday, he praised the Israeli forces and the Israeli military. And he said that the Israeli military and the Israeli security agencies have the green light to use their weapons and to kill Palestinians in cold blood. This is what happened yesterday. A 42-year-old Palestinian woman, a widowed woman, a mother of 6, she was trying to go and visit her relatives. The checkpoint was between her house and the house of her relatives. She was surprised to see Israeli soldiers pointing their weapons at her. She raised her hand, but she didn't stop as the Israeli forces immediately opened fire at her and killed her. Then later they said they didn't find any weapon with her. Yesterday there were clashes, heavy clashes in Al-Khadr near Bethlehem. 21-year-old Palestinian man was shot in the back. So it's not Israeli forces shooting Palestinians to disperse, let's say, protesters. No, they are using their weapon in order to kill Palestinians in cold blood.
A normal and legitimate response to Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. That's how Palestinians have reacted to a Thursday operation in Tel Aviv that left several people dead. There have been reactions by social media users as well. Hashtag trending brings you some of those comments.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. The situation has been tense in Israel during the past days amid consecutive Palestinian operations that has left more than a dozen Israelis dead. The Palestinian operation took place in central Tel Aviv, leaving 3 Israelis dead and some 10 others injured. The Palestinian suspect was later killed in a confrontation with Israeli troops. Palestinian resistance groups have hailed the operation as a legitimate response to continued Israeli crimes. They also say that the operation proved Israel's fragility, as well as the ability of the Palestinian resistance to take the battle to the depths of the enemy's entity. Our first tweet of the day comes from A.Ibrahim Imsabeh, Any Palestinian reaction comes as a normal response to the Israeli ongoing crimes and violations perpetrated against Palestinians along all occupied Palestinian territories. Abbas Hamida tweeted, criminal Zionists keep playing the victim card really hard on Twitter in response to Palestinian resistance. Imagine that this is only the tip of the iceberg. How long do they think they can occupy, terrorize, and continue to play victims? They're too busy getting assurances. Samer has our next tweet. The attack on Palestinian children in their capital during the month of Ramadan and the abuse they were subjected to is inevitably matched by a response in the heart of your capital that you claim. Hashtag apartheid Israel. AKM Shaladan says it's a normal reaction from a Palestinian commando against the crimes Israeli occupation forces have done to the Palestinians every day in the West Bank. For every action, there is a reaction, as is known to everyone, and this was only our response. Hashtag Free Palestine. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians have been going on even after the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and our next batch of comments showcases the aggressive behavior of Israeli troops towards the Palestinians in the occupied territories, with the first video being posted by Ghada Owais. She says, Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, collective punishment against Palestinians, demolitions, administrative detention, restricting Al-Aqsa access, cruel system of domination, and the crimes against humanity committed by Israeli authorities won't bring peace. Clearly, Israel is not looking for peace. All they want is more and more Palestinian land. Rami Abdel Jabbar said, Israeli occupation forces prevented hundreds of Palestinians from the occupied West Bank from crossing into occupied Al-Quds through Qalandiyya checkpoint to perform Friday prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque. And here we have another video posted by Oday Mohammed. This father was severely beaten on the head by the Israeli occupation police when he was defending his son and wanted to take him. These are the endless crimes of the Israeli occupation. Many have criticized the Western double standards in dealing with the situation in Ukraine and Palestine. People say that the Western support for Ukraine against the Russian offensive and their condemnation of the Palestinian resistance against Israeli occupation is the true meaning of double standards. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by Ibrahim. Lie, then lie, and manipulate the truth so that people believe you. This is how U.S. imperialism and the colonial West deal with Palestine resistance and the war in Ukraine in their false propaganda of demonizing Russia and the Palestinian resistance. The American media is not free. I mean, what else is new? That's the job of the mainstream media, to make people believe you. Mo Money has our next tweet. Western countries don't allow Palestinian nonviolent resistance like BDS and don't allow Palestinian military resistance like in Ukraine. T-Mag has our final tweet. They said, Israel accuses Russia of war crimes in Ukraine. Ahmed Mansara, a 20-year-old Palestinian, has been systematically abused in an Israeli prison for more than 6 years and his mental health is at risk. Who should accuse Israel? Well, don't expect the West to do that anytime soon, or ever for that matter. That'll do it for another Hashtag Trending. Thank you. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
In other news, hours after the ouster of Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, his supporters take to the streets to express opposition to the parliamentary no-confidence vote against him. Thousands of people rallied in different Pakistani cities. They held placards and chanted slogans in support of Khan's party, Tehreek-e-Insaf. The protesters called the dismissed prime minister the choice of the people. Khan was unseated on Sunday after a day-long impasse in parliament. Finally, the opposition secured a majority vote in support of a no-confidence motion against him. He's accused of political and economic failures, but says he's fallen victim to a U.S.-backed regime change plot. Pakistan's parliament is meeting later Monday to elect a new prime minister. Opposition leader Shehbaz Sharif is the likely candidate to replace Khan. Well, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, is joining us now to offer us more insight on that story. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the recent political turbulence that Pakistan is experiencing, and in what direction is this headed, in your opinion?
Well, the turbulence is pretty much expected. The reality is that Pakistan has been sitting on two horses. They've been trying to ride the American horse, as well as at the same time side up with China and now possibly even Russia. The Eurasian axis has a huge interest in Pakistan. And I think the more that Imran Khan began to move in that direction, of course, the more the Americans were going to get hugely nervous and have an anti-policy to Khan. The reality is that Pakistan's been in cohorts with America ever since General Zia, in particular. I mean, the period of time when they got into the habit of taking funds to oust the Russians, essentially, from Afghanistan, has continued. And the relationship of the Pakistan Army and the relationship of the nation generally to U.S. aid and the habit of taking loans from the IMF. I mean, for instance, they've taken 16 loans in 30 years, and that habit has led them to having a $90 billion debt. Now, that's a debt which Pakistan cannot pay back. It's impossible. And it's not just the debt, it's the interest that accrues on this, which actually Imran Khan was sidled with when he came in. When he came into power, Pakistan was in an awful mess at that time. To expect him to turn around the economic fortunes of the nation within a three-year period, for him not to be sort of able to do that, is not a big surprise. I mean, it would take years to get out of the mess which Pakistan was in. They have to really now look at this particular situation and the added, if you like, masala that was put into the whole mix, I think was largely done by the opposition combined with possibly the army as well. There was a point where Imran Khan objected to the new ISI officer being appointed. There was a little tug of war between General Bajwa and Imran Khan in terms of who the ISI head was going to be. That, I think, was the point where the deterioration between the army's relationship with Imran Khan began, and I think that's probably led to this current scenario. Of course, the opposition was only too willing to take advantage of such a thing. And what you have to see is that corruption is at the core of all of these situations in Pakistan. We all know that. But, you know, for 70 MNAs or MPs basically to renege on their own party is shocking. And it calls into question partly Imran Khan's own judgment about the people that he engaged, because this is one of his vulnerabilities, that he actually formed PTI from the remnants of people who had run away from other parties. Now, if you get people coming from the old corrupt system and you make them join your party, of course, you're more likely to have exactly what's happened to Imran Khan now, which is that those same corrupt politicians have just gone back to their erstwhile brothers that they worked with before, and they've done it for money. No doubt, lots of money has exchanged hands behind the scenes. And yes, very likely the Americans, who don't like Imran Khan's renegade policies regarding his moves towards the Eurasian axis and his criticisms of American drone attacks, etc., his policies in Afghanistan as well. There's lots of reasons why Imran Khan wasn't that popular with the Americans. So yes, there's every possibility that the army combined with the Americans, combined with the opposition politicians, have all got involved in this to bring him down.
All right, thanks a lot. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joining us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. Over to news from Ukraine. The country says that 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed for Monday between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from the besieged eastern regions. The planned corridors include 5 in the Luhansk region. 1 corridor is for people evacuating by private vehicle from the city of Mariupol. Ukraine says around 2,900 were evacuated through humanitarian corridors on Sunday. The UN says the conflict has so far displaced 7.1 million people inside Ukraine. The body says over 4.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since the Russian offensive started. According to UN figures, 90% of the refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities don't allow men of military age to leave the country. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. The Russian Human Rights Commissioner confirms that Moscow and Kiev have carried out another prisoner exchange despite an ongoing conflict between the two neighbors. Tatiana Moskalkova says 4 employees of Russia's Atomic Energy Corporation have returned home from Ukraine. According to the commissioner, some Russian soldiers and civilians have also been freed. The move includes the release of a number of Russian and Ukrainian truck drivers as well. Ukraine has confirmed the latest prisoner swap. The deputy prime minister says a dozen Ukrainian soldiers and 14 civilians have been freed as part of the prisoner swap. This was the third exchange of soldiers and civilians held by Kiev and Moscow since the start of the conflict. The World Bank has forecast a bleak economic outlook for Ukraine and the region amid Russia's military operation in the country. In a report, the bank predicted that Ukraine's economy would collapse by more than 45% this year. The projected figure is far worse than the 10 to 35% downturn the International Monetary Fund predicted last month. The bank added that Russia will also see a more than 11% decline in its GDP. The World Bank said the entire region is suffering from economic consequences as a result of the war, adding the conflict has caused prices of grains and energy to shoot up as well. The Washington-based institution reiterated that this is the second major shock to hit the regional economy in 2 years after the coronavirus pandemic. The United States has reaffirmed commitment to supplying arms to Ukraine in its ongoing conflict with Russia. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said his country will provide Ukraine with weapons it needs so that it will be able to beat back Russia. Sullivan added Washington has been working round the clock to deliver such weapons. That's why the Ukrainian president has expressed skepticism that Washington would arm Kiev in a way it has vowed to do. In an interview with CBS News, Vladimir Zelensky said he doesn't have the confidence that his country will be receiving the much-needed arms. He also called on the EU to impose more sanctions on Moscow. In a telephone conversation with the German chancellor, Zelensky demanded embargo on Russian oil and gas. Germany has so far resisted doing so due to its heavy reliance on Russian energy. However, Germany's gas imports from Russia have been cut by around 15%. With 97% of the votes counted in France's presidential election, incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen head for the April 24th runoff. The latest results show Macron on top with more than 27% of the votes. Le Pen comes second with over 23%. This would be a repeat of the 2017 runoff between the two candidates, but this year the gap between them has become much closer. Macron and Le Pen have campaigned on sharply imposing views from France. That is, Le Pen has pledged radical domestic and international changes for the country, but Macron criticizes her approach as one aligned with populists and xenophobes. He called the upcoming 2 weeks a decisive period for the future of France and Europe as well. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Economic Divide.
Russia has required its payments from energy sales to what it deems as unfriendly countries to be made in rubles. Its critics say that this is absurd and against their contractual obligations. Or is it a stroke of genius to bypass U.S. sanctions and strengthen Russia's national currency? Just two of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Putin issues a warning or tells Europe, pay in rubles or we'll cut off your gas. Western nations reject the switch from the currency in their gas deals. Europe is already struggling to find alternative supplies. Europe facing the prospect of losing more than a third of its gas supply. Germany, the most heavily reliant, has activated an emergency plan that could mean rationing in Europe's biggest economy. We'll see if that happens. And finally, we will take a look at energy exports and how Putin is using that to be its most powerful tool against sanctions while at the same time propping up the ruble. That means buyers of Russian gas must open ruble accounts in Russian banks. That's right, it's a new world order.
The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has already changed the geopolitics of Europe, and it's altered economic and political relations between Russia and the West. The U.S. and its allies have already imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia. They include freezing Russian assets and cutting Moscow off from the global banking system. In retaliation, Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered the government, the Central Bank, and Gazprom Bank to develop the necessary tools to switch all payments for Russian natural gas from unfriendly states to rubles. This includes countries that have targeted Russia's financial system and seized its foreign reserves in response to the crisis in Ukraine. Economists said the move is designed to try to support the ruble, which has collapsed against other currencies. This move is aimed to some degree to skirt and avoid the U.S. and European sanctions. But some analysts expressed doubt that it would work. The group of seven major economies have agreed to reject Moscow's demand to pay for Russian natural gas exports in rubles. Germany has said payment in ruble is not acceptable. It has urged the companies affected not to follow President Putin's demand. It's feared that Russia would turn off the taps now, but Germany says it's prepared for all scenarios. Yet, Europe's threats may be just hot words. After all, around 40% of Europe's oil and gas is imported from Russia. Germany is one of the most reliant EU states. U.S. promises of providing Europe's energy needs is easier said than done, especially when it comes to transport.
So will the Russian President Vladimir Putin's plan work, making unfriendly countries pay in rubles for Russian gas? Let's take a look at what people thought about it online on social media. This post said this is how serious Russia and the President Vladimir Putin are about this decision. If Europe decides not to pay in ruble, then Russia will shut down gas supplies. As a result, the existing contract will be terminated and void. Any decision to buy gas from Russia in the future will be a new contract that could be at a much higher shot price. Next post, the Russian foreign minister says a new reality is taking shape. The unipolar world is irretrievably receding into the past, and a new world is being born, that is. He goes on to say that nobody on Earth will be considered a second-rate player. All nations are equal and sovereign. Now look at what countries are doing to counter this. The U.S. has said that it would release its oil reserves, 1 million barrels per day. Now this person has said someone should tell the U.S. that strategic oil reserves are there for emergency situations, not to try and lower gas prices. Well, this tweet shows how Russia is on the winning side when it comes to its gamble. The ruble recovers. The scared Europe is losing the financial war as Europe's gas and oil payments continue to finance the Russian army. Insane. Double down on sanctions now. Okay, some of the online posts there. Well, let's find out what our guests think in this section of the Q&A. Max Perry is an independent investigative journalist and a geopolitical analyst who joins us from New York. Max Perry, welcome. Russia demanding payments for its natural gas in rubles from unfriendly countries, obviously the countries that have placed sanctions against them, adding that trust in the dollar and the euro has been compromised. And that is something that has occurred because of the West seizure of Russian assets also. What do you think the significance of this demand is? And what about the game plan that President Vladimir Putin has when it comes to the payment in rubles?
Well, first of all, I think that this demand by Russia represents a real game changer here in terms of the global financial order. The implementation of these anti-Russian sanctions, I think we can already see the beginning of their boomerang effect, so to speak, where that it's already having not just on the United States, but also the European Union. And it could mark a real turning point because we're seeing a wave of de-dollarization and, you know, the abandonment by other countries of reserve currencies like not just the dollar, but also the euro. And, you know, this, the ushering in of an era of local currencies like the ruble, which, you know, could potentially shape, reshape the world economic order and mark the end of U.S. dollar hegemony.
All right, let's bring in Mark Sloboda now. He is an international affairs and security analyst who's based in Moscow, who joins us. Mark Sloboda, welcome. The move by Russia is aimed, obviously, to some degree, to bypass the U.S. sanctions and also the European sanctions. In terms of how Russia is approaching this is what I want to ask from you, and how that's going to affect the dollar, whether it's going to knock the value of the dollar down in any respect, and whether you're going to see countries that are actually then increased their trade in national currencies.
So Russia is using an extensive toolbox, the capital controls they have, the limiting of commodities for export, as well as this move to start pricing gas and their other commodities in the rubles and only accepting rubles for the change. It is a precedent. It's not one that can be used by every country that suffers Western sanctions simply because Russian commodities, the European countries are so dependent on them to such a large degree this makes it possible because they really have no other choice. But it will lead, again, to a splintering of dollar hegemony around the world without, you know, shattering it overnight, such that countries will increasingly start to trade in each other's currencies and other reserve currencies of value to maintain their foreign policy independence.
It is time for our Info News section of the program, where we review other economic news from around the world. Our first news story concerns the IMF, who has issued a warning. Anti-Russian sanctions may weaken the U.S. dollar. Now, the IMF said the dollar would remain the major global currency, even in that landscape. But fragmentation at a smaller level, according to what the IMF has said, is certainly quite possible, meaning the restrictive measures could propel the formation of what it calls smaller currency trade deals. On to our next topic, U.S. child poverty, a story that was bad news for children in the U.S. U.S. Congress had actually found an easy way to fix child poverty, but then it walked away. Lawmakers ended a program that gave money to families in need, fearing that the money would go for non-essentials, things like cigarettes and alcohol. So bad news for children who are in poverty in America. Up next, U.S. energy profits. Who says the U.S. isn't profiting from the Ukraine crisis? U.S. oil companies, was reported, are set to reap up to $126 billion in extra profits amid the special military operation in Ukraine by Russia. It's high time for Congress, according to the report, to pass a windfall profits tax and prevent the fossil fuel industry from harnessing a war to make billions. That's according to one campaigner. All right, finally, Iran's economy recorded 4.1% growth in the first 9 months, according to Iran's central bank. Now, this is quite a feat for a country under sanctions, and it proves that Iran's president is right when he says that Iranians' livelihood is not tied to the economy nor to the JCPOA Vienna talks. Obviously, that has paid off based on the GDP growth. Well, those were some of the stories that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
So what is the big fuss anyways about Russia wanting its payments in rubles? I mean, money is money, isn't it? Well, if it were only that simple. Now, in this in-depth section, we will explain Russia's game plan. Hopefully, you'll understand it. Now, one of the reasons behind Russia's move to want ruble payments is to make sure that the ruble does not lose its value. When the special military operation began, the ruble's value fell dramatically to 85 to the euro, and then it went to 110. Only after the intervention by the Russian Central Bank, it stood at 94.12 the euro. Now, let's move on to the next item, countries that Putin expects to pay for gas in rubles. It lists them as unfriendly countries. You're going to see some of those countries, or all of those countries, which obviously are the countries that have imposed sanctions. We're looking at UK, Japan, Canada, Norway, Singapore, South Korea, Switzerland, and, of course, the UK. Now, it's noteworthy to say that some, including the U.S. and Norway, do not actually buy Russian gas. Now, at this point, let's take a look at the currency volume and the type of currency that's involved to see how large a volume that is for Russia. Well, in the year 2020, the EU was Russia's primary trading partner. According to Gazprom, 58% of its sales of gas, which goes to Europe, were settled in euros. The U.S. dollars accounted for about 39%, according to Gazprom sales. And then you have the next unit of money, which is the pound sterling, and that stood at 3%. Interesting to note here, gas imports to the EU from Russia, there are a lot. They account for 800 million euros, or 680 million pounds. That's daily spending. Every day, that money is spent. So that's a large amount of money that's being transacted. So what are the requirements for this ruble payment to take place? Well, we know that the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said, you have to pay in rubles. That is something that started this whole thing off. How then it transpires, dollar and euro payments are made to a non-sanctioned Russian bank. That bank, Gazprom, is at this point designated. The bank will open two accounts as a result of what it has done and enacted, one in rubles, then another one in foreign currency. And we're going to tell you in a second why that is. But those are the two steps that they need to take. Now, the buyers, they are going to pay in foreign currency. That's the wiggle room that has been allowed here, and that's very important. So the bank will sell the foreign currency on Moscow's currency exchange. So money will be made there also for Russia. The rubles will be placed in the rubles account after it's exchanged, or it is transformed to the unit of money, rubles. So that's how this whole process takes place. All right, let's try to get some sense out of this and an analysis on this. Our guests joining us, rejoining us will be Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst based in Moscow. Mark Sloboda, Russia demanding payments for its natural gas in rubles for unfriendly countries. We know that. But Russia has said that trust in the dollar and the euro had been compromised. Tell us more about how that has occurred, and if you agree, and what is the significance of this Russian demand overall?
Basically, what this is doing is Russia is saying that we have existing contracts with European companies and other countries to supply gas, but the currency with which you are paying us is now worthless to us because you have made them it worthless by your sanctions. This is a force majeure, and it is demanded then of us to only accept payments in a currency that we can actually, use, rubles, because you've frozen our assets overseas. We're not going to give you, you're not going to give us more money that you're just going to freeze our assets. And we're not going to give away the gas for free. And this will be done via a Russian bank, Russian Gazprom bank, where the buyers of Russian gas will have to open an account where they will deposit the payments in dollars or euros. This will be sold internal to the bank on an exchange for rubles. The rubles will then be credited to the gas producer, Gazprom itself.
All right. There you have Mark Sloboda. Max Perry also rejoins us now, independent investigative journalist and a geopolitical analyst. Max Perry, the move that Russia has actually enacted is aimed to some degree to actually want to obviously bypass these U.S. sanctions and the European sanctions. But I think Russia has other tools in its toolbox. Perhaps you can tell us about that, because we're looking at the way that Russia is going about this. Do you think that it's going to undermine the dollar as it hopes to do? And to what degree do you think that will be?
Yes, I think this is definitely a strategy aimed at counteracting the sanctions and bypassing American economic warfare. And this, that's been a pattern in the advent of this multipolar world we've seen emerging, where, for example, a country like Iran, which is under these maximum pressure sanctions, or Venezuela, which is also under embargo, this, in addition to the fact that these sanctions have not produced the regime change that these countries are targeted for, these global South countries that have been in the gun sights of imperialism, but those countries have been able to bypass those sanctions by integrating themselves with Russia and China's Eurasian economic infrastructure, which has been built independent of, dollar hegemony. And so for a perfect example is how ironic it was that the United States had to reach out to Venezuela and reach out to Caracas to potentially allow oil purchases, and they may even in the future end up lifting the sanctions that they had placed on Venezuela because these sanctions that they've now placed on Russia are going to have such an impact on the global financial market on energy. So how ironic is that plot twist? So I think part of the pattern here with this multipolar world that's emerging is that we're seeing, countries like Russia or Iran or Venezuela be able to get around the U.S. and its economic warfare.
Different estimates of the impact of a gas boycott or embargo on Europe, but most involve a substantial loss of economic output, especially since the war and the resulting surge in energy and raw material prices is already weighing on Europe's economy. It appears the U.S. is trying to benefit from the Ukraine crisis to its own benefits. The crisis could also push Europe to buy the raw material it needs from the U.S. instead of Russia. That includes agricultural products like grain and mineral commodities like nickel and aluminum. Russia has other tools to skirt Western sanctions. It's eyeing closer cooperation with countries like Iran and China. According to recent data from the Russian Federal Customs Service, as of January 2022, China accounted for 19% of all Russian trade. That is more than twice the value of Russia's trade with its next largest market, Germany, with 7.4%, and almost six times the value of its trade with the U.S., with 3.3%. The U.S. embargo on advanced chips is likely to have far-reaching consequences for Russia's military and industrial development over the long term in Russia. A surge in demand from Russia could provide the necessary impetus for this sector's further development in China. Sanctions on Russian exports also secure cheap food and energy, adding impetus to plans that were already underway before the Ukraine war. The cooperation between Moscow and Beijing could push China and Russia to use their own currencies in their bilateral trade. And this can weaken the global dominance of the dollar.
So, are there any benefits to paying in rubles, or will European countries actually suffer a loss because of this? That depends on a country's imports. In the case of the European Union, for the year 2021, imports increased to a record high, increasing by 23%, with exports increasing by 13%. What does this mean? Well, for one thing, it means that businesses are finding themselves making more payments to foreign suppliers, which brings us to the question, what's more optimal, paying in euros or US dollars, or paying in the supplier's local currency? The answer to that question should be pretty straightforward. What makes more economic sense? And the answer may surprise you. For European businesses, setting invoices in euros or US dollars may seem the easiest, most hassle-free way to pay. However, there may be benefits to paying invoices in the supplier's local currency. Some of those include earning discounts on purchases, extending payment terms, fixing payment amounts and settlement terms, and improving trading partner relationship. Just think about it. For years, the majority of European imports have been invoiced and paid in euros and US dollars. This is what the head of the Foreign Exchange Bank has said. The reality is that paying invoices in the currency of the originating supplier isn't so complicated, and it can have benefits. After all, you are offering a convenience to your supplier. There can be value in that. If that isn't enough to make buyers think twice before making payments in euros or dollars, maybe this would. If foreign suppliers are billing in euros or in US dollars, they're typically going to pad the price of goods by up to 2% or more. So, in the case of Russia, it has required energy commodities to be paid in rubles. So, why not other products, you may ask? Well, just before recording this program, Russia made that announcement also. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said that a ruble payment scheme that Russia currently uses with gas would be extended to new groups of goods in the future. So, there you have it. As you can see, paying then in rubles is not that bad if the proper diplomatic and non-aggressive approach is used, especially when it comes to Russia.
My final comments, let me ask you a question. Who tells you how much your currency is worth? The United States? Europe? Think about it. The White House owns the dollar. The European Parliament owns the euro. And Downing Street owns the pound. They sure use their currencies how they want it, especially the United States, which has weaponized the dollar against other countries. Russia owns the ruble, and it can decide how much it's worth. And more good news for the ruble, Russia may soon back it with gold. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you on board. Questions and comments, we always look forward to them. From Economic Pathway, it's goodbye. Until the next program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi al-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he wrote a letter to his commander Malik al-Ashtar as he sent him as a governor to Egypt, he gave him a list of instructions, and these instructions Malik had to apply in order to preserve the rights of people. So it is the human rights of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the charter of human rights of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, is the most comprehensive charter of human rights that we have today. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen gave him many, many instructions. But there's one that he left for last, the most important one of them all, which is pretty much the core of all these rights. In order for a person to apply human rights and make sure that the rights of others are maintained and preserved, first he has to make sure that he is fit for the task. In the sense, he needs to fight himself. He needs to make sure that he is in the right position. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says to him, shun self-adoration and do not indulge in self-praise. Now, that's a massive issue, especially with those who are in power. So with power, not only comes a great responsibility, as it is stated in Spider-Man, but with power comes danger, comes self-conceit, self-pride, self-ego, and all that. Because when you are in power and people look at you as an authority figure, then you feel that you are God, like Fir'aun said, Ana Rabbukum al-A'la, I am your Lord. It leads a person to think like that. So the Amir al-Mu'mineen says to him, maintaining human rights, preserving human rights, giving people their rights, has to begin from the fact that you are fit for the job. And to first to begin with cleansing yourself from self-praise and self-indulgence. And he says, nor encourage others to exalt you, and nor encourage others to extol you. Because sometimes you might not have a self-praise issue, but people do. And people usually, they love that. They love to, you know, speak highly of other people, trying to seek their attention or their approval or even their wealth, right? So we have that even today, where people, as we say, they are sucking up to someone else. And this is something that's not Islamically frowned upon. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen, one day he was walking and a person got up, or people got up, and he said to them, why? They said to him, well, you know, something that we do to respect our elders. He says, you know what? Sit down. Nor will you benefit, nor am I going to increase. So this is just a bad action. It's not required. So sometimes people do that. And the more people do it and we don't say anything about it, it will get in our heads. It will make me feel and think that, yeah, maybe I am like that. So he's saying to him, don't do it yourself. And make sure you don't let people do it to you. Otherwise, you will become self-centered. And in return, people's right will be taken away from them. Let's take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Also, in terms of trying to maintain and apply human rights, there are things are required for a person to have to be in that position. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says to Malik in that letter, do not make haste to do a thing before its time, which is very important. Sometimes the state or the government or the people in authority, they have plans to do things. But sometimes what happens is that they try to initiate and work their plans before either their due time or due course or before revenue and money is available. And then when they start doing it and it becomes premature because they have not thought it clearly, it falls out and then you have infrastructure and you have things are half done. And I sometimes walk in the streets and I can see that with my own eyes. So I'm saying to him, in order to maintain the rights of people, you yourself, don't be too hasty, don't be too quick to make things that have not, it's not time for them yet. Keep that in mind. Not put it off when the right moment arrives. Sometimes vice versa. It is the appropriate time to give people something that they require the most. For example, infrastructure. For example, transport. It is the right time to give it to them. That's when people need it the most. But you see that the governments, for example, don't do it. They just don't care. Then they end up depriving people of their rights. So in terms of not doing it before it's time and not delaying it, one needs to have that self-control and that self-equilibrium, to say the least. Then he says to him, do not insist on doing a wrong thing, which is also a basic human right, especially when we talk about the masses, when we talk about the subjects and citizens of a country or a system, where sometimes those who are in power, they do something wrong that deprive people of their rights. But yet, governments insist on doing the same thing. Even they can see that people are being harmed, people are suffering because of it, they keep doing it. Nor show slackness in rectifying a wrong thing. Sometimes you know it's wrong. The governments can see that this is wrong. This is taking the rights of people. Why not fix it? They can see that raising prices, or when the prices rise, people start to suffer, especially the poor class. They suffer the most. They can see that. It could be fixed. It could be easily fixed. But yet, they refuse to do so. So he says, don't slack in that case. Make sure you do it. Perform everything at its proper time and let everything occupy its proper place. So time and place makes a huge difference in trying to maintain the rights of people. So those are specific traits that a person needs to have in order, not just from a moral perspective. So we're not talking about morally here. We're talking about the fact that it needs to be done, and the person needs to have them in order to make sure that the human rights are applied and preserved. Without these traits within a person, then the rights of people will be taken away. We leave it up to here. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.